Read to him the 29th scroll. 6th verse.
Beware the beast man, for he is the devil's pawn. Alone among God's primates, he kills for sport or lust or greed. Yea, he will murder his brother to possess his brother's land. Let him not breed in great numbers, for he will make a desert of his home and yours. Shun him, drive him back into his jungle lair, for he is the harbinger of death.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, Planet of the Apes Retrospective Series.
My friends, I have convened this extraordinary meeting of the Council in order that I may report upon an action which I deemed necessary.
Join Matt.
You are a good and wise ape.
Garrett.
The human way is violence and death.
And Adam.
The only thing they fear more than me is you apes.
As they travel through the spectrum of Earth and into the Forbidden Zone, and consequently dissect the most primitive of all film franchises.
My God, did we finally do it?
From the Charlton Heston starring 1968 original,
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
To director Tim Burton's 2001 remake,
We've been searching for you for so long.
All the way through the latest entry, 2024's Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
I don't believe it!
The man will see, the man will do, their opinions of how good or inferior each movie in the series truly is.
He has a definite gift for mimicry.
All coming up, courtesy of Percolated Media.
All of human history has led to this moment.
Planet of the Apes, 2001. Released July 27th, 2001. Budget was $100 million, the box office take of $362 million, and this was directed by Tim Burton. All right, boys, last time we talked about Tim Burton, he was in the wintry hellscape of Gotham City 10 years prior to this with Batman Returns, and it's been almost 30 years since we've done a Planet of the Apes movie.
Yeah, and I think me and Adam teased last week that this is the first one we've seen out of this series. And, you know, I'm going to do something very rare right now where I'm going to go ahead and read a Letterboxd review I did of this May 2nd, 2016. It's only a couple sentences. And what it says is, count this as one of my most deeply rooted guilty pleasures. I get a lot of joy out of Burton's take on material that I'm admittedly not too familiar with. My interest coming back to this film was whether or not the fact that we have gone through the movies that this was based on from back in the 70s and come back and still find this to be a guilty pleasure, still find this to be something that I actually really enjoyed, despite the fact, God, this thing just took a drubbing when it was released. And I was one of its staunch defenders, even back then. So after seeing all the Apes films, and coming in, what was I going to think? That's what I was kind of thinking about as I was watching it for this podcast.
I was trying to put my mind back into what I was thinking of Tim Burton at the time. Because, you know, some of his films I was a big fan of. Some of them I absolutely cannot stand whatsoever. Looking at you, Mars Attacks. So I was trying to remember just how I was feeling, but it was a new millennium. This was the first one I'd seen. I remember the hype about this film being pretty big, you know, the effects and Rick Baker and Tim Burton doing this, and he's the perfect kooky kind of, so the press was just swallowing this thing whole before it came out. And I was one of them. I was just like, you know what, I've heard about this thing, can't wait to do it. Of course, the guy that brought me Beetlejuice and Batman, and now he's going to bring the Apes, and just the casting news was, you know, front page of Entertainment Weekly and that kind of shit. So I was excited for it. And yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen it. And now going through it in the shadow of five previous Apes films, I was ready to see how I'd feel again.
Context is key, like with a lot of these retrospectives, but one thing worth noting is, as you alluded to, this thing took a drumming. Like, it might as well have been put in a cage and beaten like the characters in this movie, because remember, put yourself back in the late 90s when this thing was starting to come together, although it had development history before, which we'll talk about shortly. The idea of remaking a classic, a bona fide classic of the genre, of any genre, was looked at as cinematic heresy. And before this, you had the remake of Psycho, which really put a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths for the word remake. But a funny thing happened. Tim Burton, to his credit, did not use the word remake. He kept using the word reimagining when he talked about his Planet of the Apes movie, but that's sort of a conversation we'll get to a little bit later. But 30 years, the fact that nowadays we live in a world where within a decade this was rebooted again and has another movie coming out now, back then this was kind of the, if you were going to bring a franchise back, you had to wait a considerable amount of time.
Well, and then another interesting thing happened. A couple years before this, Burton had a pretty well-received remake of his own called Sleepy Hollow that I actually saw in theaters and really enjoyed. So, yeah, count me as being excited when this was being released.
We'll talk about where Burton was in very shortly, but I was just going to say, boot it over to Adam. That does not mean that even though there were 30 years in between, that Planet of the Apes was still not a... It was not a dormant franchise by any means.
We talked about the TV show. There'd been comic adaptation works. There'd been animated, I want to say. So, yeah, it definitely wasn't. And, Garrett, you bring up Sleepy Hollow. And I have a love-hate with that because that's one of my favorite stories. That probably is The Legend of Ichabod Crane. It's one of my favorite Disney animated pieces, which I always find the funny part that the man fired from Disney over the Black Cauldron has done so many Disney pieces, You know, tangentially. I remember one thing about Sleepy Hollow, and I watch it every year, and one thing sticks around to me, and it's Christopher Walken's freaking teeth.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he's got a mouth fetish like Quentin does for feet, because that mouth fetish kind of shows up in this film, too.
Not necessarily a fetish for it, but he has a weird affinity for mouths. Like, you know, there's that part in Batman where Joker spits out the fake teeth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's scenes in this, you know, you have Dark Shadows, there's a gag with him brushing his teeth, and there's no reflection because he's a vampire.
Funny thing about Sleepy Hollow is that was the last movie me and Adam actually saw together until Guardians of the Galaxy, like 15 years later.
And Sleepy Hollow, to Burton's credit, that is very much a reimagining, where he took the source material, which is a short story, and it's only half of an animated feature from Disney. Like, people think of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow is one of their animated films. It's that and Mr. Toad.
That and Mr. Toad, yeah.
Combined to make a 65-minute short. So, do the math, it's only 30 minutes. But why did this take so long to come about? Well, we got to go back to the mid-80s, which is a great time for movies, especially if you're a fan of the cult or certainly science fiction and horror. A guy by the name of Adam Rifkin was brought in to pitch some ideas for a new Planet of the Apes film. Now, this guy was behind, at the time, not necessarily a whole lot. It wasn't until post-development that he started to put his name out there that he wanted to continue the series, do a film post-battle. But in conversations with Fox and President Craig Baumgarten, they eventually said, let's not do a sequel to the fifth film, and kind of do like an alternative sequel to the first one. So kind of like what we think of like the requel nowadays. Mm-hmm. It kind of sounds like what that was going to be, where apparently it was going to be a Spartacus-inspired film where the apes had basically become the Romans. And there was a descendant of Charlton Heston's character who would lead a human slave revolution. And it was supposed to be a real sword and sandal type of sci-fi film, but for some reason, that never, despite going into pre-production and hiring Rick Baker and Danny Elfman, well before Burton was ever attached, and well before this thing ever changed into what it became, there were certain people in play that stuck around throughout the entire development.
Yeah, and there's another interesting through line, too, when you talk about this and the old series, is the original producer, who had worked with Burton, I believe, six times in his life before he passed away, Richard Zanuck, who also produced one of my favorite movies of all time, Jaws. He's on board as a producer too. So I don't know if maybe he was the one who kind of convinced Burton to come after this was in development hell for, God, had to have been, you said mid-80s. So this took about 15 years to get on screen. I didn't know that it took that long.
Oh, this one's got a hell of a development history, because that film is going to be called Return to the Planet of the Apes. Apparently, both Tom Cruise and Charlie Sheen were who they were looking at to star. Because when I think of Charlton Heston, I think of 5'5" Tom Cruise.
You know what, man?
And a coked out Charlie Sheen.
You know what, man? Tom Cruise was, by the late 80s, mid to late 80s, Tom Cruise was the biggest star in the world. So I could see why you would want to cast him. I mean, they were wanting to cast him as Iron Man, for Christ's sake, by the 90s. So I could definitely see him in this Wahlberg role if they were going to go this way. If they were even going that way. Was it always this story? You said it was going to be Return, right?
It was called Return to the Planet of the Apes, and then they were all set to go, and then some studio executive changed at Fox. So Rifkin threw that script out. They demanded rewrites. And then it changed again once Peter Jackson got involved.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he pitched, along with Fran Walsh, who I think is his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Now his wife.
Yeah, they're married.
They pitched a Renaissance period ape film where the ape government was getting concerned about the humans using art as expression. And then the big plot was about sheltering a half-human, half-ape from the gorillas. Roddy McDowall apparently liked the idea a lot, and he said he wanted to play a character in that film. But the executive that Peter Jackson was involved with now did not like the series. So he had no idea that Roddy McDowall was ever even involved. So Peter Jackson said, I'm going to focus on heavenly creatures instead, and that project basically died.
Isn't Peter Jackson's career trajectory so interesting? Like, this is a guy who, he came up with these little films, you know, Bad Taste, and he had that Meet the Feebles, I think, that one with
it's like the Muppet Show with drugs and alcohol.
Yeah, it's insane. And he had so many almost starts and stops. Remember, Matt, we talked about way back when we did the Nightmare series, we talked about the fact that he was involved with Nightmare 5 for a long time. Not 5, it was actually 6. Yeah. He was involved with Nightmare 6, Freddy's Dead, for a long time. I mean, this guy had so many. I mean, talk about being determined to actually make it. And eventually, within a decade or so, he'd be the biggest filmmaker in the world. It's just, you know, we're going to cover The Lord of the Rings eventually. And I'm really anxious to talk about his actual career. Just the fact that you mentioned that, you know, he was almost on this as well. It's just like, man, there had to have been times when he was just like, fuck, man, is this ever going to work? Am I ever going to make a big film here?
So shit gets even weirder from here. The project changed again, so this is like the third storyline. Oliver Stone was considered to direct this.
Unbelievable.
And, all right, so this is the quote from Oliver Stone. Tell me if this sounds familiar to another film that released in 1993. It has the discovery of cryogenically frozen apes who hold secret numeric codes to the Bible that foretold the end of civilization. My concept is that there's a code inscribed in the Bible that predicts all historical events. So basically, he was making a Roland Emmerich movie before Roland Emmerich was ever a thing.
Oliver Stone's movies do not age well. And I think if he had done a Planet of the Apes movie and he had gone with that crazy concept, which sounds ridiculous, it doesn't even, you know, there's science fiction, and then there's ways of just making it so ridiculous that, you know, you alienate your audience. And that's exactly what that concept would have done.
And Oliver Stone did not stick around. The script got a lot of good praise, though. It's to the point where Arnold Schwarzenegger signed on to play the lead.
I heard about this, yeah.
Provided he got to approve the director. There was a director hired, Phil Noyce. Fox basically said this is too different from what Oliver Stone had pitched. And they basically said, you know what, F this. And they burned it a cinder. So again, they try again with Chris Columbus doing a script written by Sam Hamm.
I want to talk about a guy that successfully reboots, though. I mean, that's somebody you'd go with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and then Columbus had done, what, just Home Alone at this point?
Home Alone, and of course he wrote Gremlins, too. The original Gremlins. He'd been lingering around, you know, him and Spielberg, you know, he was attached to Spielberg's hip for a while. And I think at this point, yeah, I think his biggest thing was Home Alone.
So this one was the same ham script, speaking of Tim Burton connections.
Interesting.
Well, very loose, because if you go back and listen to our 89 show, a lot of his script didn't actually make the final cut. Mm-hmm. His story was that there was an ape astronaut who lands in New York Harbor, and there's a virus that makes human beings extinct thanks to his landing. And they use the spacecraft to return to the planet of origin looking for a cure. And they go to the ape planet where they're being, like, hunted. It's basically a kind of like the inverse of Predator, where they go to, like, the ape homeworld and they're actually, like, sounds like borderline a slasher film, because Schwarzenegger was still attached, even at this point. Columbus dropped out to go work on Jingle All the Way. Great decision there. James Cameron was then talked to. He said he wanted to do something along the mix of the first two. But Cameron made so much money off Titanic that the studio couldn't afford him. So they went back to Peter Jackson. Like, the production of this movie is one of the most extensive you will find of any movie. They go back to Peter Jackson. This is after he had done The Frighteners and Heavenly Creatures, so he had a lot of cachet now. Nowhere near what he'd get just a few years later. They said, hey, let's go back to your original idea. And he basically turned it down because he knew he would not get along with Schwarzenegger.
He knew he wouldn't get along with Schwarzenegger.
He basically said, like, my vision and him will not coexist. Schwarzenegger eventually left the project. And then they went to the master of destruction himself, Michael Bay.
Listen to how many filmmakers are attached to this fucking movie.
Michael Bay said he had no interest. And then they went to the Hughes brothers.
The Dead Presidents guys? Really?
They were from making Hell? From Hell.
Yeah.
They chose to stick with that. So all of this happens. How the fuck does Tim Burton get involved? That's the question.
Well, I think I answered it earlier. I think Zanuck probably had something to do with that.
He walked into the wrong set and just stayed.
So 1999 finally rolls around. And Fox said, all right, the movie's coming out in July 2001. They approached William Broyles to do an outline. Tim Burton got hold of the script, and he was hired. So Tim Burton, let's talk about where he was at this point. You mentioned Sleepy Hollow, and it's been 10 years since Batman Returns. He had done Ed Wood, which did not make much money, despite getting critical praise across the board and a couple of Oscars. Yeah. He then did Mars Attacks, which was a massive bomb. Despite having one of the most star-studded casts you will ever see in a movie. Like, it's insane when you read that cast. I want to know what the call sheets look like on some of those days. It's insane. But did not do well, so Tim Burton made Sleepy Hollow, which was a hit. But here's the thing. This movie represents, although not directly, because we're going to talk about the movie and whether or not you can tell it's a Tim Burton production, because that's something worth mentioning. Oh. This started the trend that would define Tim Burton for the last 25 years, where he basically is hired and producers tell him, here's a pre-established property. Burtonize it. Go. Because it's this, it's Willy Wonka, it's Sweeney Todd, it's Alice in Wonderland, it's Dumbo, it's basically everything he has done since this movie outside of Big Eyes, which is very different from his usual stuff, and is actually a really good movie. And Sweeney Todd, actually, that was a property where I'm like, okay, this fits like a glove. But you hear Tim Burton in Planet of the Apes, you go, huh, definitely not what I would have thought, but people said the same thing about Batman. The guy who made Beetlejuice and Pee-wee is going to do Batman?
Yeah, Apes does not fit Burton well. You're absolutely right. When you think about Tim Burton, everything you just mentioned, Mars Attacks, even Ed Wood, which was actually a really, you know, serious film, and like you said, garnered a couple Oscars. You think of Planet of the Apes, you think of big blockbusters like that, and Burton's name does not come to mind. And so that's why I was racking my brain. At the time, I didn't really think about it, but since we're doing the series and since we covered these films, it just looks like they were like backed against a wall and Burton had an extra few months, and so they're like, come on to this project, please, we need you to save it. And are you going to talk about the other writers they brought in? Because boy, they're worth mentioning.
Yes. So once Burton was signed on, which, for all intents and purposes, despite his interest, it's kind of like a director for hire job when you take a step back.
Yeah, and he has said, too, that this was a miserable experience for him. At the time, they were talking, you know, sequels and whatnot, and after this was over, he was like, fuck that. He hated the experience of making this movie.
Well, this was also the largest production he had ever done, really.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
When you look at the scale, the budget, but he said, and the quote, as I mentioned, he talked about reimagining. You know, like with Willy Wonka, I wanted to reimagine I was watching Gene Wilder's movie while watching his. He said, I wasn't interested in doing a remake or a sequel, but I was intrigued at the idea of revisiting that world. I wanted to do a reimagining. And then Burton, once he signed on, Broyles wrote another draft, but his script would have cost about $200 million. Fox said, we want to make this for $100.
I love this.
So, two months before they started shooting, they bring in Lawrence Connor and Mark Rosenthal.
Adam, do you recognize those names? No. Okay, go.
We have talked about one of their movies previously.
Just last year.
These are the writers behind Superman IV, The Quest for
Yes.
Peace. Oh my God. Oh, that explains so much.
And we will talk about them again next year when we do Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes
they have some resume. And by the way, Superman 4 was also notorious for they chopped the budget on that one too.
And these guys also wrote, they must have an ape fetish because they wrote Mighty Joe Young in 1998. Mm-hmm. Now these guys, despite what we've alluded to, they've written some good stuff. They were writers on The Sopranos.
Yeah.
They wrote Boardwalk Empire. They have some writing credits on, but they were brought in for rewrites, and Broyle basically said, I don't know about this. The question was, all right, how do we end this movie? Which is going to be a conversation in and of itself. One of the ideas was that Leo crash lands at Yankee Stadium, and he sees apes playing baseball.
Love that idea. I love that idea.
You would.
Don't explain it. Just, he shows up, and that's it.
You have apes in uniforms playing baseball. Adam, get the fuck out of here. You cannot like that idea.
Absolutely fantastic.
Well, as an A's fan, I guess you would like that idea.
That's not how they went through dozens of ideas to end this movie before they settled on what they ultimately chose. And as you mentioned, Tim Burton was not a very harmonious shoot for him because Fox, like we talked about with X-Men, they had a hard release date. And you hit that release date come hell or high water. They were rewriting the script as they were constructing sets. Like character changes, all that kind of stuff.
It's the same experience we talked about, Matt, when we talked about Batman. It's the same thing.
Yeah, except unlike, say, Batman Returns, they did not give Tim Burton a blank check.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm talking this Batman 89. I'm not talking Batman Returns.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like this had almost as extensive a production history as 89 alone. Mm-hmm. The movie came out and got mixed reviews. Some things were highly praised, and there were some things that were basically condemned across the board. To the point where, while the movie made money, plans for a sequel were canceled.
How much money does this thing make?
$352
Wow.
For a budget for $100 million. Yeah, so this was a big...
It made a profit.
And you look at movies that came out, you know, 2001, you had stuff like Pearl Harbor, you had the first Lord of the Rings, the first Harry Potter. So it made money. It's not like this was a bomb by any means, but between the mixed critical reception and just not hitting where I guess they wanted, it didn't warrant a sequel to the point where the next film is just a reboot.
Yeah.
This, when you have films like this where, okay, we're going to try to, you know, do the rebutical thing, and then you bring in writer after writer after writer, but then your end product has to differentiate itself so much that those writers can't go to the guild and get story credit, get writing credit, because then you got to pay them and you got to give them their points. And when you're suddenly, when you have paid for a dozen drafts that never come to screen, no wonder the Hollywood studio system is in such disarray for so long now. And it's because of situations just like this. And it's sad because this fiasco is Disney right now. you know, where it's just like, hey, hire a monkey's a monkey's room of writers to spit out as many scripts as possible, and we hope one of them we can film by the date that we've demanded somebody hit. It's unbelievable.
Well, Matt, how many times have you, and even you, Adam, I think we've talked about it too, how many times have we spoke about the fact that a lot of these movies, they spend $60-65 million before they even roll before cameras. You know, that's not using your budget wisely.
No, and Fox, remember, the year before this, they cut a lot of the budget from X-Men, too, the first one.
That's right.
Which is why that movie takes place at a gift shop.
I can't wait to talk about that with you guys.
Yeah, so let's get into the movie, because there's a lot to discuss. Now, the one thing I will say about this movie before we go into it, the trailer is outstanding.
It's fantastic. I watched it, too.
It really makes it look like this full-scale, like, you would think this movie should have been called War for the Planet of the Apes. Unlike the 2017 one, just based on the scale, you get to see all the apes. They're showing you it's a different world. Like, it's not a, this is not Gus Van Sant's Psycho, where it is a copy and paste remake. It is, Burton is correct in calling it a reimagining.
Yeah, and they have the shots too of like ape. I think it's Tim Roth's Thade character, like coming up and looking at the camera, you know, out of nowhere, those kinds of shots. Yeah, it's a very good trailer. And Adam was right. The hype for this thing was huge. I remember a lot of it, and I'll talk about it as we talk about the movie. There's certain things that are really comedy when it comes to the hype of it. But, yeah, the trailers and stuff they put together, really well done.
And I will say, and I knew him well back then, but that casting of Thade had me as excited about anything in this film. I really was excited about Tim Roth in this.
Now, why is that? Because it's not like Tim Roth is a huge name.
Yeah.
No, but I knew him from certain things. And when I saw that character and just saw the look of it, I was like, oh, okay, this just looks, and not having ever seen the other one, so I can't even really compare, you know, with the antagonist we got from those first five. But there was just something about him portraying this way that was physical, you know, so it wasn't like we got in Phantom Menace and that, where it was a CG character, but it was a different character. It was obviously not human, and somebody in that suit and the makeup, you know, that Baker did, it was just, I was excited. And Tim Roth, knowing him just a little, I thought he was going to be something special, and I'll say now, he is in this.
Now, he did get this role, but he kind of paid a heavy price to get it.
Yep.
When we talk about what he missed out on.
Mm-hmm.
But we open in 2029. On the U.S. Air Force.
Only 5 years from
Jesus
now.
Jesus Christ, that was so long ahead of time.
I mean, technically, we opened with opening credits where they're scanning over, like, the ape costuming, and the ape opens its eyes.
Yeah, let's talk about those opening credits. Yeah, you're really setting things up. And then we're also getting a Danny Elfman score, because back in these days, Danny Elfman and Tim Burton were exclusive. And you know what? You know what came to mind, boys, as I was watching these opening credits? Remember how we spoke about the fact that John Williams took The Lost World and put bongos in it and made it completely different? There are pieces here that are okay, but this is one of the lesser Elfman scores.
Oh yeah, this one's very percussion-heavy. Yeah. It's got a jungle aesthetic. But, you know, these are cool opening credits. I like the monochromatic type of grayscale that they use. And you're showing off the ape makeup without showing too much.
Mm-hmm.
I think the score is pedestrian. I don't think there's anything that you could call without, if you don't put the name up, I don't think you'd have any idea who composed it. I think you could give a dozen different studio composers and every one of them would feel right. But this opening sequence, it almost feels Tim Burton-y, because remember that 89 Batman where you're kind of going through the catacombs and you don't realize you're going through the bat symbol? It feels like that, but it also feels like the opening of an Alien movie.
Yeah, I got that feeling too.
You would get. Yeah, I was like, damn, this could be the opening to Alien Romulus that's coming out this year. It's just that kind of sensation that you would get from a Fox sci-fi film.
Yeah, and talking about Danny Elfman, I think this was a time where Danny Elfman was starting to get kind of complacent. You know, he had some remarkable scores back in the early to mid-90s, and by this time he was just kind of falling back on his laurels. Now, there is a score he did a couple years from this point where I think it's one of the best scores of his career, and we'll talk about that movie eventually. But here, as you mentioned, Adam, very pedestrian.
So So we open on the U.S. Air Force Space Station Oberon, which looks like the Trade Federation ship from Phantom Menace.
Well, 2 years before. Yeah.
But it's literally, it's that same, it looks like Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, the main base, and then you got the rings surrounding it. We're introduced to Pericles the monkey, who is failing his, chimpanzee, to be politically correct, where he is trying to do his docking scenario, but he fails, and he's told to try again by Captain Leo Davidson, played by Marky Mark himself. And we've talked about Mark Wahlberg-Yard a couple times on The Departed, and we talked about him in The Happening. I gotta say, this performance is a lot closer to the second one than it is.
So, you are so right. And I did not remember it this way. You know, I talk about the fact that, you know, I was a big defender of this movie, and I thought that Wahlberg was okay at that time, but you watch it now, I was watching it with a critical eye, you are absolutely right. He is so fucking wooden in this role, and he is so miscast. And you know what? He also did with this, Matt, the same exact thing he did with The Happening, whereas when Rise was coming out, he talked about how much Tim Burton fucked this movie up and saying that we could have done that movie, but we didn't do it right. And you know what, man? You bad-mouthing these movies like this has gotten you to where you are right now, where you're pretty much just exclusively working with Peter Berg. This performance is not one of his best. 5 years later, he would get that Oscar nomination. But yeah, this is bad.
There's background chimps that never speak that give a better performance than Marky Mark does for almost a film. And yes, we're going to call him Marky Mark.
Yes.
And that's not necessarily an insult, but I'm sorry. When you grew up in the 80s and 90s, that's who he was. He was doing underwear commercials and freaking on Bill.
Yeah, hell, this was only about 5-6 years after that, you know, this role.
Yeah, to the point that he refused to wear a loincloth because he was worried that it was going to be, like, fucking back in those underwear. So I admire him for wanting to branch out, and he's become, you know, something else. But when you put two models and you expect them to kind of carry your film, you might want to make sure one of them has the ability to act. And in this film, neither one of them do.
We also have to acknowledge that I think he's miscast, but I also have never considered Tim Burton to be a great actor's director.
Oh, no.
Because, A, he lets them really do what they want as long as they stick to his vision. And I don't feel like Mark Wahlberg directed at all, because you look at his scenes in this opening where he's talking on the spaceship. I get the sense Mark Wahlberg thinks he's making legitimate science fiction.
Yeah, he's thinking he's in 2001 in this.
Yeah, he thinks he's making that or The Silent Earth or Forbidden Planet, like these really, you know, upscale. When in reality, Tim Burton's treating this like a B movie with a capital B, not just because his last name is Burton.
Which isn't the wrong choice to take if everybody's in on it.
No.
You know, but yeah, Wahlberg, it feels like he's being directed by the B squad.
No, it feels like he's being directed by M. Night Shyamalan, because it's the exact same situation.
Yeah, like if somebody shot him where they'll do close ups on his face and he has that same like mouth agape expression that he has throughout a lot of The Happening.
Yeah.
The mouth breathers, I swear.
Right away it does not set you off on a good note. And I was thinking, like, you know, around this time, because it's 2001, if you needed a sexy, like, lead, Matt Damon was available, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I guess you could have gotten, like, Colin Farrell.
Yep, you could have got Affleck. You talked about Pearl Harbor.
Yeah,
you know, at that time, he was just breaking.
Yeah, Affleck was on the downturn at that point. He would not have really carried this, I don't think.
We would have got stuck with Josh Hartnett.
Yeah.
Although, considering Mark Wahlberg is objectively, I think he's bad in this. But I don't think he's a bad actor. It's been the weirdest thing with him, where you look at the movies he did before this, shows a bit of diversity, you know, Basketball Diaries, Fear, Three Kings. You know, he showed he could act. But it's got to be Boogie Nights. But it's got to be from a director who knows how to pull something out of him.
Yeah.
And, you know, Scorsese will do this in a couple of years. But yeah, he is the sexy, just white male lead. And that does not set the movie off on a good note. Mm-hmm.
I did find it kind of cute to open with the ape here, you know, in the suit, because it made me think of the Apenauts from Escape the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, good call.
And I was like, you know what? That feels like a cute little nod. And God knows Tim Burton, going all the way back to Batman, he doesn't exactly do research beyond what he decides he wants to do. But I could see in, throughout the course of this movie, little either incidental or little cute little references without making it, you know, in your face. And that's what I felt here with I can't remember the monkey's name. Oberon's the space station, right?
Pericles.
Pericles. God, that's a horrible name. That's right. Pericles.
Oh, there's one that's completely in your face, but we'll get to it.
The references of this movie range from cute and innocuous to
obnoxious.
taking out a glove and slapping you with it repeatedly.
Yes.
This space exploration is investigating an electromagnetic storm that is approaching the station. They send Pericles out in a little space pod, but he gets sucked into this vortex somehow. So Leo decides to break from... So this whole movie could have been prevented if Mark Wahlberg just did his job.
Yes.
So it's this guy's fault that humanity is doomed at the end of the day.
And you give him the name Leo. Like, are you trying to cast DiCaprio here? Why? It's a terrible name for a lead in this movie.
Leo Davidson.
Yes.
LD, Leo DiCaprio. Yeah.
This space anomaly one, could it look more like it was taken from one of the bad Star Trek movies? On top of it, it's like 20 feet away from the space station. You know? It's like, hey, wait a minute. Look out the window. Guess what's about to crash into us?
Hmm.
I swear to God, Fox recycled this footage for their 2005 Fantastic Four space storm.
Damn it. Cross off that. Nope.
Same shit. So Leo gets in the pod to investigate, and he gets sucked into the storm. He loses contact with his ship, and as he's being sucked into the vortex, we're seeing that time is jumping forward. So unlike the first original Planet of the Apes, where it's revealed that they've jumped forward in time, this movie is being very straightforward with saying, yeah, he is jumping into the future, and he lands in 5021 AD.
Oh, that the year 5020? Okay. I didn't get the end year, but I saw that it was going as far as it did. Okay.
I think this crash is so good. I like the crash here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, I like how, I mean, look, he lands in frickin' Naboo's puddle.
That's my note.
He lands in Naboo in the daytime, and then he gets out of Dagobah okay. at night.
All right, I'm so glad you brought this up. Yeah. Yeah, the production design on this is terrible, because you're absolutely right. There's times when it looks like they're on Dagobah. There are times when it looks like they're on fucking Tatooine. Like, they don't know what the hell they're filming here.
They don't know the geography of this planet at all. It's like the movie keeps forgetting that it's supposed to be one climate. Now, I know it's the Planet of the Apes, but given the trek they go on later, and whether or not doing the math in your head as far as the distance, why are there so many disparate temperate environments in a day's walk?
Yeah.
And also the color palette in this movie is just ugly as sin. It's very drab. It's dreary. Some parts you can't even tell what's happening. It's just for a Tim Burton movie, where I know a lot of his films get criticized for being overly CG, which this movie really is not. There is a lot of practical work. But the color palette he shoots with is just hideous.
Yeah, I agree with that. And he has a $100 million budget, which you know, is not a small amount. But in 2001, I mean, that's kind of minuscule considering what they need to do here. And the fact that 20th Century Fox slashed this budget. So he's doing what he can. But yeah, there are times when there's projection behind, and the palette and everything else in this movie and the production design is really, really shoddy, to put it lightly.
Yes, this movie's 20 years old. You know what? Freaking Minority Report came out the next year. And just look at the leap in quality between those two films.
Well, look at the production, though. You know, and it is the same studio, too. Just look at the production.
And I do think if Tim Burton had shepherded this from the beginning, I think we might be getting a different film.
I agree with that.
Oh, yeah. This would have been a lot more of an alien-looking planet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, Alien is an extraterrestrial, not Alien is in the Fox movies.
Yes.
Although I'm convinced the DP of this film worked on frickin' Alien Covenant, because it looks like that same goddamn forest.
Yeah.
He lands at the rainforest, and he stumbles upon a group of humans, where, unlike the original film where humans are mute completely, these humans are capable of speech. But the one commonality is he shows up and they're being chased by apes. Now, the movie does not give you any kind of forbearing dread of the apes arriving. They just show up shrieking, and you get full glimpse of the makeup right away, which is still as impressive a makeup job as you will ever see.
My biggest compliments to this movie is going to be to the makeup design here. And this is Rick Baker, as we've mentioned earlier. Now, Rick Baker is one of those guys who he really wanted to do a Planet of the Apes movie so bad. And he did King Kong probably about, 20 or so years before this.
That was 76.
Yeah. So about 25 years before this, and he hated the way that came out. He hated the way it just did not look, quote unquote, real. So he's on this, and he wanted to do it as authentic as possible and give it a real good look. And I got to tell you, every single one of these actors, you know, we have Giamatti, we have Clark Duncan, we have Tim Roth, all of which we'll talk about. They're so distinctive in their ape design, and you can tell who's who. And that is due to just the remarkable way that Rick Baker has designed this movie. The production design did not show up. The makeup design did. Rick Baker, this is some of Rick Baker's best work.
Some of it is. Some of it feels freaking phoned in from 2029.
Oh, come on. You can't tell me there's one ape here that looks like it's phoned in.
No, I'll give you two, and we're going to get there really quick, so I'll do it now. I think Michael Clark Duncan looks horrible. It looks like they slapped on a mask and a wig. The fact that his face doesn't move, only his mouth does, I feel completely disconnected. And it felt like all they did was throw mud on Giamatti's face.
Wow.
Now, I appreciate, and I think some of the other ones look amazing, but even back in 2001, I knew I was just watching Paul Giamatti, and to get Michael Clark Duncan to make him stand there, and basically what felt like you put a black man in blackface that... He's like the only ape that doesn't have the ability to emote. Everybody else, yes, I think looks fan-frickin-tastic.
I'll give Clark Duncan this. Clark Duncan literally wandered off the set of a movie we're going to talk about here in a set of years where Matt's kids are in high school. he had just walked off the set of The Green Mile to be in this movie. And maybe it's just because they didn't want to use him that much. They didn't really show the makeup that much. But I don't know, man. I can tell it's him. Matt, be the tiebreaker here.
Oh, I know it's him because of that voice.
Yeah, of course.
But also...
Daredevil.
Well, I was thinking he walked off the set of Scorpion King, but that was a year later. Because yeah. kind of playing a similar role where, yeah, I think the makeup job is excellent across the board. I like how all the classes look distinct because you got one of the main... And they're all different, like chimpanzee, you have the gorilla, you have Giamatti's orangutan, so you're getting a different scale. But I think a lot of it is because... These performances have very distinctive voices that it's pretty easy to tell who's who. But I also think they don't linger on Clark Duncan so much to avoid the potential controversy of putting him in blackface.
Yeah.
But the humans are being rounded up, and we're seeing everyone from, you know, one of the highwaymen himself, Chris
Whistler, wandered off the set.
Whistler walked off a plate, too.
He made this movie because his kids, like, love Tim Burton. And he's got eight of them, so that he has a lot of people that he has to please.
Yeah, he... Looks like he's phoned it in.
Yeah, he looks like how he does
to do with this film.
He looks how, like, he does in the Blade sequel. Yes. It's like, really? You asked me to come back again, yes. And then you're going to kill me again?
Yeah. Poor Whistler.
We're introduced to his daughter, Dana, played by Estella Warren, who is also a model.
Hot model. I remember her being extreme. Like, I had a huge crush on Estella Warren because she was on Sports Illustrated and everything else around this time. And Adam hit on this earlier, and he's absolutely right. She is just bad in this.
God, awful. It's amazing because there was two movies relatively close who featured, oh my goodness, these models are breaking through. It was this and Estella Warren, who, not my model, that was Garrett. And Josie Marin, when she did the frickin' Hugh Jackman Vampire Hunter, Van Helsing, big deal about her and that. And suddenly models were going to be these Estella Warren is, like, she's not bad. She's abysmal. She can't perform. She can't close that frickin' mouth that looks like she got punched in it and her lips are swollen. Like, if you're going to try to copy Angelina Jolie and Gia, try to have some type of ability. But she is... It's amazing that she went on to have as many credits as she did, because she is just, oh my God. I feel bad for Burton for actually having to put her on camera. You know, you look at the people he had to direct in this film, maybe he did give it all to second unit, because Jesus, if I was Tim Burton, I'm surprised he didn't walk up this set.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't complaining that she was wearing a loincloth, though. She still looks hot in this. I'll give her that.
Oh, she does, but she's got less range than Rock. And yet, cave woman who can't balance on rocks and wears a lot of lip gloss.
Yeah, the lip gloss was really distracting.
Yeah, I totally buy her as a savage cave woman. Like, her and Mark Wahlberg, they feel like Fox mandates, and I'm sure Tim, this was truly his vision. All the way through, he would not have cast them. He would have cast Winona Ryder and Johnny Depp. It would have been those two. Or it would have been Christina Ricci.
Oh, my girl, Winona. She was busy stealing from Saks around this time.
She was. God.
So they're all getting rounded up and put in cages once again, because that happens in the original. We're introduced to General Thade, played by the aforementioned Tim Roth, who was the big villain of this movie. And yeah, people knew who he was largely because of Pulp Fiction. He had some other credits, like in Rob Roy, he's the villain in that. And you talk about commitment, he is fully immersed in this role, much like Danny DeVito was in Batman Returns. That's kind of the comp. He's terrific, as are all the ape actors. Like, you can tell they really, the difference between actors and actors is prominent in this movie, mm-hmm. where all the actors who play the apes underwent very extensive movement classes to learn how to walk like primates would. And it's amazing to watch. But I'm sure if he had a time machine and it was between this and Harry Potter, I still think he would have taken the latter.
He could have been Gray Snape. I would give him that. I love Rickman. He could have pulled it off as well. The only thing is his mannerisms are so distant. Like, he doesn't walk like any of the other apes. So he does command a presence anytime he's just walking into a room. Because his gait, given that, he still seems a little more animalistic than some of the other apes in this.
And he's always doing something on screen, too, if you notice. Yep. There's always some action going on. The comparison I came up with was Heath Ledger wear things during the Dark Knight. And Tim Roth has committed to that as well. I think he's great as well. And again, I'm going to compliment his makeup, because that makeup job is tremendous. And man, Tim Roth, when he, I never thought that he could play a mean dude. You know, it just never came to mind. I see him in Reservoir Dogs, and I saw him in Pulp Fiction, and here's a guy who was kind of pushed into those situations. But here he is the actual antagonist. He is actually the asshole starting this whole fucking thing against these humans, and he is just mean and evil. And I like seeing the side of Tim Roth in this. I really did.
Ever seen Rob Roy?
Long, long, long time ago.
Oh, because you fucking hate him in that movie, so you can't wait to see him get killed.
Yeah, I might have to check that out.
This is like that makeup is seamless. Yeah. Like, there's no the flesh is back far enough that every movement that he's making underneath it is coming through and giving that extra emoting through the makeup. And bravo to him and to Baker for the look of this.
Yeah, he's also able to act through the makeup, which. Yep. Is a challenge in and of itself, because his is probably the most comprehensive, mm-hmm. looking at everything from the face structure to the armor he's wearing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's certainly clearly the villain of the movie, but and they've tried this before, like the militaristic villain of the apes, but this is definitely the best executed, although he doesn't have the deepest of worldview, but I like how this movie taps into divine right for his family. And they're kind of supposed to be descendants of the first ape.
Yep.
So that's why they have as much power as they do. But he's basically as anti-human as you can get, loads them all up to go be sold into slavery. We're also introduced to seeing ape civilization in this context, where kids are playing basketball in the streets and they're living in, like, they almost look like Rio de Janeiro, where the houses are built on top of each other. Almost like a tree house. So I do think there is a lot of work that went into how this world looks, but that's my problem with Tim Burton in general. He's too in love with the visual aesthetics, and unfortunately this story and the script, there's nothing to grip you.
Yeah, this movie really represents a place in history, because this came out 2 months before 9/11. And this was the last time you could actually see a movie like this and see civilizations like this and actually feel like you're enjoying what you're watching, you know, feel like it's fiction. And you're right. Burton is building this world, but I don't think he's fully committed to it. I think he's right. He's not giving much direction here. And I'm a huge Burton defender. Go back to those Batman films. I find what he's doing here to just kind of be going through the motions. And that's pretty disappointing. But again, this is a guy who we'll talk about his personal life here in a bit. But he was going through a lot with that. But he was, and again, he was just miserable on the set. So maybe he is milling it in to prove a point. Or maybe he is literally just not as committed as they would have liked to have him to have been.
I feel like he was given all the production design and he was told that that's what you have to shoot with, and that's not his way. He likes to build it. He likes to do all that, and I think it's kind of clear he didn't get that opportunity this time.
When this DVD had come out, I did get it for Christmas that year, and there's a huge set of making ofs on that. There's a whole disc of them, and everybody's talking to the actors and how much they love working with Tim Burton and they wanted to work with him. Burton's not really featured on that making of, and that's told a lot to me, especially when I read that, you know, he just did not like this production at all. I just don't feel like he's committed, you know. I don't know how else to say it. We'll see if he's committed to Beetlejuice 2, but when it comes to Planet of the Apes, he's not.
Well, as I alluded to earlier, this feels so unlike a lot of Tim Burton's other productions. Even the ones I don't like, I clearly see, you know, he's got a very particular style with his art direction, with his camera angles. Thematically, a lot of the stuff he touches on. Yes, this movie deals with outsiders, but at the cost of making this just a shitty white savior movie. And that's one of the real damning things is that, yeah, this is, there's a component of that in the original, but it's only because he's the sole human left that's really focused on. But here it's, oh, you're going to save us all, and it's a futuristic white hero. Speaking of commitments or lack thereof, we're also introduced to Ari, who is the daughter of the senator, played by Helena Bonham Carter. Now, as you mentioned, Garrett, this is the movie where Burton and Bonham Carter sort of hooked up, and they would become partners for numerous years after this, both on screen and personally. So here's my question. Do they have television in this universe, specifically Friends, because she has the Rachel haircut?
That's great. And the funny thing, okay, let's get into this now. The funniest thing about this whole thing is his girlfriend at that time was a stripper by the name of Lisa Marie. Stripper slash actress, because Burton put her in, you know, he put her in Ed Wood, you know, she's in this too. She's one of the apes here. And here is Bonham Carter over here on the side. And his life was in fucking shambles, boys, after this. To the point where, like, 5 years after this, Lisa Marie actually took the belongings that he left at her house and sold them on eBay. That's how pissed she was at how this ended. And Burton was really angry at that as well. Let's talk about Bonham Carter. You know what? We've talked about her a few times on this podcast. You know, go back to the Potter shows. And, you know, we make fun of the fact that we've said it 100 times where at this time it was his go-to. No, he put her in Alice in Wonderland. He put her in all these projects, and we can make fun of the fact that he does that. But you know what? When she's in these projects, she's really good. And I like her here. She's very likable in this role. It's not written too well, but I do think that, you know, she has a presence where she feels for these people. Now, the fact that she's feeling for underwear model Mark Wahlberg at this time, that has a lot to do with the chemistry or lack thereof. But I don't mind her here. I actually kind of like her.
Like her in this? Ugh. I love her in this film. I think she's amazing. I think the makeup is phenomenal. As much as there's a clear look of Zira that they're bringing out here, I remember the news and articles and Entertainment Tonight being like, you're going to fall in love with an ape. And people are like, what the fuck is that? And then the controversy behind that. I do. I think she's phenomenal in this. Her acting through the makeup, much like Roth, really shines through. I get the empathy from her. She is amazing in this film, even through all the makeup.
I think she's great, and I don't blame Burton for putting her in, because she fits the part she plays. It's not like she plays the same character over and over like I've accused Johnny Depp of doing.
Well, yeah. Yeah, and that was the comparison I made too, Matt, because, you know, you mentioned that with Johnny Depp, and I thought you were going to go there with her, but I'm glad that you mentioned that, because, yeah, she is playing a different character every time. Don't forget, she was also an It Girl at this time too, because she had been in Fight Club 2 years before this, which didn't make too much money, but people, you know, really liked her in it. And, you know, I mean, this is a girl who lived with her parents till she was like 35 or something like
she
that.
She didn't live with me.
You know, and at this point, she had some ambition to really do something with herself and actually do some really good stuff. And she did, you know, later on, like you guys mentioned. I mean, she's great in Potter. I was on her side in those films. And here I'm with you as well. I think she's tremendous in this.
My criticism is not with her performance, is that I just think the character is almost written to be a teenager. With that
still
living with her father, and she's got like that rebellion part that's pretty atypical for teenage girls. So I'm always confused as to how old she's supposed to be. But that's more of an issue with the writing, is that I feel like these characters are not as well defined as they should be, both the humans and even some of the apes. But she sort of makes it very well known that she is opposed to how humans are being mistreated. But we're also introduced to Limbo the orangutan, played by also previously mentioned Paul Giamatti, who said when he heard that Tim Burton wanted him in this role and his agent said, "You want to play a human?" He said, "If you make me a human, I will fucking kill you."
I fucking love Paul Giamatti.
He's also the only he's the levity of this movie.
He is.
But this could have been the Jar Jar Binks character, and thankfully he's not. Or more like more like Watto, I guess.
We're really close to being Jar Jar Binks in this.
Oh, I find him funny. I think he plays Slimy well. Oh,
I do too.
And yeah,
it's
there's
a
point
movie that he's in that everybody else is in though.
I'll give you that, but I'm not going to call him Jar Jar in this. I think Matt said it. He brings levity, and when he's on screen, I laugh almost every single time. And you know, he does make the face turn. You know, he does go to the other side by the end. But the way Paul Giamatti plays it, and the makeup, I'll give the makeup as well. It's endearing.
Like, I know Paul Giamatti because of the voice. Like, he's got a very voice.
Oh yeah, yeah. For
and
sure.
I'll say I like what he's doing. I think he obviously stands out, like much like Tim Roth and much like, you know, Bonham Carter. He steals the screen every second he's on it. I think he is just in a different, completely different version of this movie than everybody else is.
He's playing it much more for camp. He's more of like the escape version of the apes that you see, where they're a little bit more, it's a little bit lighter, a little bit more comical. Tim Roth is playing this like he's in Beneath, where it is like, you know, I am playing this deathly serious, and it works. And Bonham Carter is sort of somewhere in between. Like, she feels like Zero from the first movie.
Yeah, and you know what, Matt? It's funny. Going through this series with you guys, this is when I'll bring this up. One of the comparisons I'll make, I would not have made that comparison to Zero if I had not watched those films with you guys. Okay. So kudos to them for actually alluding to that without actually calling it out.
So Limbo is a slave trader, so I guess he's more like Watto than Jar Jar. And he's putting them all into cages. He's talking about how, like, the worst thing you can have in your house is a human teenager, because Fade comes with his niece to get a And I thought, you know, this is a movie that has a ton of references. I thought she was going to be named Nova, because she's a blonde girl. Yeah. Thankfully, they don't do that, although, given some of the stuff they do later, it would not have been as egregious. Because, by the way, when we're introduced to Michael Clark Duncan, he says, "Take your paws off me, you damn dirty human." I forgot to mention that because I had that in my notes, and I hate that the way that line is used, because that's like a big deal in the first movie where it's like, oh my god, they realize he's capable of speech. Here it's just a instead of a wink and a nod, it's a kick to the balls.
It's what J.J. Abrams would have done.
Oh god, is something later on, I swear to god, J.J. Abrams ghost directed.
I'm telling you.
It's like a line made for a TV spot and no other reason.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even I, who had not seen that first film when this had come out, of course I knew of that line. You know, so when he said it, at the time I thought, oh, that's kind of cute, but I watch it now. I do groan because, you know, as you mentioned, Matt, I mean, the power behind that in that first film was huge. And here they're just doing it just to make the audience laugh, and didn't work here.
Well, it's the, hey, remember this?
Yeah.
Which I've accused a lot of movies of doing, which we'll talk about. Ari buys Leo and Dana from Limbo to go work in her father's house, this movie's chock full of great British actors because he's played by David Warner. They see him in a role where here the humans are 100% slaves, which is really, it's not that the other movies have not tackled this. It's just off-putting here because Tim Burton is also making a comment, not just about race and slavery, but about how our treatment of animals, putting them in cages and doing tricks, is as bad as slavery. And Tim Burton is not the right director to be making this kind of a statement. Because, look, he's great at what he does, but I would not call him a maverick when it comes to social statements. There's a little bit of that in Beetlejuice about how the Malins have to become part of society again. They can't be, like, gerrymandered.
But even back in Pee-wee, you know, there's some of that outcast society type of feel. The threads don't come together to tie. You know, the only thing I got from this, yeah, it felt a little bit like Conquest, where we had apes that were, you know, cooking food and doing that, and I felt like they flipped it for this scene.
They're living in decent conditions, you know, because, like, they have beds and cages, but it's not there. Mm-hmm. Not like they're starving in the streets. But her father has a bunch of the elite come over, including General Thade and a couple of other people, and we get sort of this is the exposition about how this world works, where humans are looked at as nothing but inferior, despite there being talks about, oh god, speaking of Star Wars prequels, once they started talking about the Senate, I was like, oh no.
This is the movie party scene where you can use a party to get your exposition out there and showcase a bunch of different characters. I like the way everybody looks around the table. We get a couple different apes. They look pretty cool. The big old fat senator with his young trophy bride, you know, I think it's a cute little, nod to reality. And I like what's going on here around the table.
Dave mentions he's late because he was tending to his father. More on that later. And Dave basically talks about how we need to exterminate all the humans, and based on what we find out in this movie, he's kind of right.
Yes.
But society, much like the original film, it's sort of broken into classes where you have a military side, although led by a chimpanzee, they're not all gorillas.
And
you
have, they have some of it, but it's not quite as clear-cut as it was before.
No, it's not 100% defined by sub-races of the apes. It's also not like they don't really talk much about science in this movie. Which I guess makes sense, because the science of this movie is bullshit and nonsensical. We'll get into great detail on.
And you know what really stuck out to me, too, while watching this, boys, was we talked about with those previous films, they all had something to say. This movie is made as a crowd pleaser. This movie is made to be a blockbuster to make money. This movie was not made to say anything. You have Mark Wahlberg in the lead role. You're not going to have too many political statements to make here, especially in 2001. So I was finding myself lost in the middle of this movie. Well, I was just thinking, what are they really trying to do here? And I just came to the conclusion, this is just a science fiction film with really nothing to say. And when I talked about those last Apes movies, I gave most of them pretty high scores, and the highest scores I gave were ones that had something to say and did it in a way that wasn't in your face. The stuff they do in here is in your face, but it's not saying anything politically. It's giving bad references to previous films.
Once all the apes sort of leave, Ari breaks them out and the humans try to escape, including Leo, who clearly can speak, so it's sort of a different dynamic where they're, because the humans can speak, there's not that danger of him being with other humans, like they're not savages, but they look at him as like, oh, you're dressed differently, so clearly you must know where to go. Through his logic, he spends the whole movie looking for his old ship, because he keeps finding the homing beacon that somehow still works. So they're all being led astray, they're trying to escape. Chris Christopherson is killed by Clark Duncan's character, so he took his paycheck and ran.
Yes.
And, this is where you really see how bad Estella Warren is, because she can't bring herself to emote or shed a tear whatsoever. Like, they have to take her off screen because she couldn't bear to watch her father die, but it's largely because she couldn't portray how that would feel. To the point where they have the other characters tell her how she should feel.
But even, like, you see, every death is off screen. It's all cutaway. Even when we get Thade starting to go, everything is just, you see it coming, you see a weapon, and then we're going to whip Pan away from it.
I don't think you see anyone directly impaled throughout this entire movie. Like, people get stabbed, people get quote unquote shot, but you never actually see any blood or penetration.
We get blown up and then stand up.
Nope.
Meanwhile, we have Abby return, which basically has a scene where Batman puts a bomb on someone and they explode, albeit off screen, but you know what he meant.
Guys, we're trying to appeal to kids here. And if you have people blown up into pieces, they're not going to be able to bring the kids in. What was this? This was PG-13,
right? Yeah, I don't feel like this movie's catering to a kid audience because it's so, outside of Paul Giamatti, it's very dull and it's not outright funny.
No, but I do think there's more adventure here than what we had before. You know,
operates on kid logic of we have to get to our destination before the apes find us. Like, because this movie is like The Lost World, where so much of it is just a dumb, or Jurassic Park 3, where it's just a chase.
I was going Two Towers, where we get through this opening and now we're going to start fucking walking for a while.
That's all the Lord of the Rings movies. Oh God, we'll get to that later this year. Thade is taken to the pond where Leo crashed, and he kills the subordinates to try to cover this up, because, as we'll find out, there's sort of a prophecy.
It picks me off so much. If you had explained why, and if you had made it clear the lineage, how important it was, and that there was this secret, this could have been an important moment. Instead, all this does is turn this into a piss-poor sci-fi action movie with all you're doing is establishing, hey, in case you didn't understand, this is your murderous antagonist. This doesn't serve much of anything.
Speaking of not serving, they realize that Leo's told about Kalima, which is this movie's version of the Forbidden Place, but this one's got a holy temple surrounding it where they talk about Seamos, who is the first ape that civilization has sprung from, at least in this time frame, and everyone else looks at him as a god. So the bulk of this movie is them getting to Kalima, which, as we'll find out, is not as it seems.
Anyone else think
every time they say it.
Sorry, that was in my notes.
I literally said it out loud. Kalima!
Dave tries to convince the senator to declare martial law so he can go out and hunt them, because he has the pull of your daughter set them free and I'm the only person who can rescue them, to which he reluctantly agrees for them to go be hunted down. We then cut back to this ragtag group of boring-ass humans. I mean, I feel like the only reason Paul Giamatti and Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa, who also distinctive voice, like,
he's
I know who that is right away. The only reason the apes are here is because they knew the humans suck.
Yep.
We got to rewrite this so that it's somewhat interesting.
Give me those two. Mm-hmm. Put the humans back in cages. Give me those two apes, orangutan and ape. Like, I would watch those two in scenes over and over and over because they're both acting through their makeup. They're at least enjoyable to watch together, and they give. It's amazing that they can give a performance that fucking humans can't give.
Now, and they're trying to set up Ari romantically involved with Leo, which just comes off as off-putting. Because in the first one, you know, it's difficult to not compare it, despite being a very much its own thing. He kisses her at the end mostly as a saying goodbye, not out of romantic lust or anything of that sort. Here it plays off like they're trying to set up a love triangle with also Estella Warren's character.
And that was spoken of at the time. There was Entertainment Tonight, E.T., those kind of things, talking about there's controversy over the forbidden love of an ape and a human. Like, that was part of the press to this thing, and I know it got cut out of some countries and shit, and I like it, and I could have used more of it, and I would have went with it perfectly okay.
Yeah, it's not at the forefront, though, mm-hmm. because
no.
you have actors, two of the three, who can't bring that to the forefront. And the movie's not preoccupied with that. It's just, we have to get them back. We have to get to the finish line, is basically the bulk of this movie. Like, it's a dumb blockbuster, but as we'll talk about, it also kind of fails at being a blockbuster because the action sucks.
Yeah.
Action's not good. I remember the action being much better than what
it looks a lot better in the trailers.
Yeah, for sure.
Before Thade leaves, he goes to see his dying father. Oh, boy. Played by Charlton Heston, under extensive ape makeup. And it's kind of, it feels wrong because right around this time, I think he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And it plays like he is oblivious to where he is. Even though he's giving a performance, and I think it's kind of horseshit they nominated him for a Razzie, because again, he's as good as the other ape actors. for the little time he's here.
I don't know about that. I get why they did it. This also kind of came off as in poor taste, because this was 2 years after Columbine, and here he is giving the main antagonist a gun to finish the job. And I do know that Tim Roth had objections to that, even though this is a guy who killed how many people in the Tarantino films he was in?
Roth's defense, I think everyone he kills in Reservoir Dogs is in self-defense.
He objected to being given a gun by Charlton Heston, even though this fucker has been in movies where he's waving a fucking gun around. So that feels a little dumb to me. And this performance, I don't think he's really giving a performance. I think he kind of got the call. He showed up. He got in the makeup. And he just kind of went through the motions, as we kind of talked about when we did the Apes film. But he's, as you mentioned, he's much more riddled here. I do agree with the fact that he got a Razzie nomination, because I don't feel this performance at all. I just feel it as a tribute, not necessarily a somebody giving a performance.
Funny that I didn't look ahead of time to see who this was, and while it's going on, I'm like, why is that so familiar? And it took me a moment to realize I wasn't listening to Sebastian Stan at the end of Return of the Jedi, because you know, I'm waiting for the "you were right." I like the inclusion of the gun here, because to me it goes into the time travel aspect, and I think it sets up, I hate what they do with it in this film later, but at this point, I think it's a really good setup for what the possibility could be. It just sucks that it's so unfulfilling later on. And then his last words.
I'm getting to that. Oh, God. But he reveals that humans will spell doom. And there is sort of like, harkening back to Zaius in the first one, keeping origins secretive.
Mm-hmm.
I like that that's still connected, because he smashes the pot and it's a gun generations before this timeline. But he says, "Damn them all to hell," before he dies. Like, this is the, I think this is, I feel about this the way Star Wars fans feel about Darth Vader yelling no. Like, this is so fucking bad.
And the way Burton, he keeps this take and he moves on. You fucking do another take after this. This is terrible.
I bet Heston was like, "You got one shot."
Or rewrite the fucking line. What's that?
Heston was like, "You get one of these." Yeah, that's all I'm giving you. You know, it's amazing when I think of this gun and time travel and all that. Because what else belongs to Fox that did the exact same thing? Predator. Time travel. That freaking revolver. Yeah. Predator 2, Prey. It's amazing how it came back in there.
Oh, yeah, you're right. So you're saying when he flies back, the Statue of Liberty should have been in the shape of a mandibled big game hunter. So Thade assembles his army, and they all set off to go track down Leo and company, which sounds like the group Mark Wahlberg hung around with in the mid-90s.
And this design for the ape army and their armor, this I feel was Burton really loving Bram Stoker's Dracula, because you can't tell me this bodysuit under the armor isn't that armor you see at the very beginning of that film. That muscle sinewy armor. To me, it's the exact same bodysuit.
I thought you were going to complain about how they're wearing snails for helmets. I think those look comical.
It's a take.
Leo and company arrive at a ape camp, and they have to cross one way or the other, but Ari reveals that apes hate water. I thought science came out in 2002.
Was this established in those previous films? I was trying to think. Did the apes actually say they don't like water in those films?
I don't think they ever actually do.
I'm trying to think.
I didn't think so.
I thought there was one where they were scared to cross. Yeah, maybe not.
Might have been. I mean, we watched these. It's been a couple months since we last did the apes. Yeah. But yeah, this was never a huge...
And so it was glossed over.
Yeah, if it was, it was not brought to the forefront. But right when they... When Leo shows them the pod he landed in, they all kind of clinch up because they hate water.
Which but means they, you know, they're going to have to go in water.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
They get on the horses and they lay siege to the camp. Ari tries to trade herself for the humans to get free, but she's burned with the branding iron. He's not having any of it. But the way Burton shoots action is, you can tell it's not his forte, because there's so many low angle shots. Like earlier on in the chase when they're being rounded up, that you can't tell who's who. he's climbing way too quickly, and sometimes the people on horseback, it looks like you can clearly see the stunt doubles.
Yeah, and you mentioned this scene with Carter, and I think she's doing an okay job in this scene. I think she's doing a pretty good job, actually. But the way, as you mentioned, the way they shoot this, like, I'm supposed to really emphasize with this character, and I'm not having much feeling here. I'm just feeling like he's going from point A to point B without pausing to give us any chance to emphasize with these characters.
Well, because now they're no longer characters. They are just props in his in his world. They managed to cross the cross the stream, talking about another property we'll be getting very soon. But again, it makes it kind of removes some of the aura of Thade, because even he won't cross the water.
I thought we were going to get that push the Trollocs across the water. Back to Rings, not Wheel of Time. Push the orcs across the water type of moment where he was going to force them across, or he was at least going to show that they could cross. But yeah, that he doesn't. Like, okay. It you would think that would undermine his authority or his respect, because at least she crossed the water, and this human crossed the water.
Yeah, exactly. So eventually they make their way to Kalima. I giggle every day at that. So Leo goes inside, and he realizes that it's the remnants of the Oberon. And we find out that everything that's happened is entirely his fault, because when it crashed, the apes that they had in captivity took their guns and killed them, and they are the prime, no pun intended, ancestors of the apes that run this planet now. So I like this, it harkens back to kind of the time loop of, like, inevitability that the first one kind of wrestles with. But I hate how it resolves at the end, which is, we'll talk about. Well, what is really dumb when they really literally spell out Kalima is just short from caution live animals. God, that is so dumb.
Yeah, I had, you know what? I mentioned that I had liked this movie when it first came out. I did used to watch it a lot way back when, but I did not remember how bad the dialogue is in this and how bad the action is. Like, I was really, really disappointed in myself and thinking, God, this was actually pretty good back in 2001. I'm watching it now, and I'm just seeing the flaws just hit me right in the face.
I mean, speaking of flaws, we finally get the big, sort of like, Tim Burton's framing this like a Western, almost like The Magnificent Seven, where they're vastly outnumbered, so they have to use traps to, you know, take on the apes. I mean, they use the ship because it's got enough fuel, since it's powered by nuclear energy, which I thought was going to play in and blow up the planet.
The nuclear vessels.
Nope, he uses it once, and apparently
that's there. It's a fucking firecracker.
It's a giant flamethrower, but it's only got enough convenient fuel for one blast, because the apes show up and a bunch of them get incinerated, although they all survive it, and then they all get beat up by the humans.
They fly everywhere just to get back up.
Yeah, like they fly, they got third degree burns, but
they G.I. Joe'd this.
Oh, this is like the
G.I.
Apex. This is like the bad antithesis of the Battle of Naboo at the end of Phantom Menace, where, like, all the apes do is just jump, and, you know, they don't have guns. It's just, it's so poorly shot, too. And it takes place in the desert, so there's sand everywhere. So you can't tell, like, the geography of this battle is almost impossible to comprehend through parts of it.
But it's just, you've been waiting for this type of action. Because it's really, I mean, there's been little moments, but it's been a pretty actionless film.
Yeah.
You had the camp scene earlier where they're breaking, and that was, I mean, that was a poor scene. It was poorly shot, poorly directed. I mean, that was ugly to go through. And this here, you finally got your big action piece, and this is a disappointment on pretty much every level.
Especially if you were someone who was critical of battle. Mm. You know, this is really a battle for the Planet of the Apes in a lot of ways, and it's pretty underwhelming.
Yeah, like I mentioned in that podcast, you hear a title like Battle for the Planet of the Apes, you think there's going to be a long-ass battle, and there really wasn't. You had the technology in 2001 to do this. You have kind of the budget to do it. I don't know if they ran out of money or if this is a director who is distracted and not into what he's doing, but you guys are right. There's no real good action going on here. And I remembered the battle being pretty fun.
Yeah,
The battle is not.
I was looking forward to this ending because, I thought it... But then yes. I went back and I'm like, you know what? Tim Burton doesn't do action. And he can't do action. And I don't think he likes it. I think he wants to tell a story where action is bad and action is, it's not artsy. And it's, I think he was required to do it. And I don't think he has the capability or inclination, which is fine, but then hire someone to do it.
Yeah. In the 9-10 years since Batman Returns, he hasn't really learned to film action that much better than what he did
then. He still has not, because he repeats this problem in Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where it ends with a big battle that you can't really tell what's happening. Just when it looks like all hope is lost and the humans are about to get their asses kicked, there's a vehicle that descends from the sky, and he realizes, oh my god, it's Pericles.
What the fuck?
I did not remember how this ended. I thought Same. They were all going to just, like, worship, and I thought something else was going to happen in the ship that was going to, or that Pericles was going to walk out and he was already here, but somehow it makes enough of a light that they all look up and it stops this entire battle cold.
Mm-hmm.
I had forgotten about this oblivion looking spaceship, you know, landing here on this planet. Oh, god damn, I forgot about this.
And we have to pause as they worship C-3PO here.
But hey, Apenauts. So
yeah. Yeah.
But I think it's Seema. Like, this is Jesus being reborn.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, we got the fourth best actor in this film finally returning to screen.
I love you, Adam.
But as Adam mentioned, the apes bow because they interpret this as the return of Seimos. Pericles runs into the wreck of the Oberon. Thade and Leo chase after him. This hand-to-hand fight scene is comical because, speaking of Batman, this has the wire work of Batman and Robin.
Yes, mm-hmm. I swear I saw wire on one of these shots they never removed.
If you're sensitive to animal cruelty, don't watch this movie because they just picks up Pericles and throws him against the wall. Oh, it's so obviously a dummy. Thade tries to shoot Leo, but he closes the automatic door, so he's trapped inside.
And Thade is being very ferocious here, you know. And like I said, Tim Roth is bringing it. And I'm not faulting Tim Roth in this battle at all. I'm faulting the staging of it. I'm faulting the direction of it. And quite frankly, I'm faulting Wahlberg as well. I don't think any of the other elements are into what's going on here except for Tim Roth.
I think you could have had such a beautiful story moment to end this. Mm-hmm. If the religion with Seimos mattered, that you suddenly mm-hmm. had all these apes watching their new leader, Thade, about to kill Jesus, you know, who returned, mm-hmm. ape kill ape, ape no kill ape, and then with the gun, like, you would have had a moment here of watching the ape society grow because they're going to turn on Thade. The only reason I'm thinking about that is because of five films that started in the 60s that told better parables than this one is telling.
Well, this one has just reduced it to a dumb action movie.
Yeah. This is Scott Bay. I mean, this is 90s action being done in 2001.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this
shot just as well, yep. too.
And Thade gets scared off by the ricochets, so he's defeated just by huddling under a desk. And Leo decides that he has made everything right. He has, quote-unquote, saved the day. So he thinks, decides to return to Earth, and he gives Pericles to Ares as a gift with a very awkward farewell to both her and Estella Warren.
I swear the only reason they had him kiss Estella Warren as well is because he kissed Carter first. And I get more passion out of that one than I get out of Estella Warren, because neither one of those mouth breathers can close their mouth for a kiss.
I also think I have to review Twilight just so he can bitch about that for four movies.
You know what? I kind of like the tribute to the first film when Ari kisses him. I thought that was cool. Again, I wouldn't have put that together if I hadn't watched that first film. But yeah, a lot of this other stuff is just comical.
I got no problem with the Ari part. You know, the whole controversy over, is she crushing on him? Is he crushing on her? Like, yes, and I absolutely feel that. And I got no issue with it, and I think that's more meaningful than any other relationship in this movie. So I like the kiss with Ari, and I think it's a proper way before he takes, you know, leaves. I got no reason why he'd be kissing, God, not even bright eyes, empty eyes over there at Stella Warren. There's been no chemistry between them.
Oh, she looks hot.
That's funny. Says goodbye, he gets on the pod, and he returns to Earth through the same storm that he seemingly was sucked into, and he lands in Washington, D.C.
Yay! Credits!
As you see, it's not the D.C. he remembers. Stumbles upon the Lincoln Memorial, which is now a monument to General Thade. He's then confronted by cops and news reporters, who are all revealed to be apes.
Yes. A little bit of background here. So I did see this in theaters opening weekend. In fact, I think I saw it opening night. And I went, Adam, with a friend of ours named, remember Leaf? I went with him. Himself. And he told me in the beginning.
Is that Thanos that? Himself?
Yeah,
he did the mocap for the Thanos punch in Sony.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. I went with him, and he told me in the beginning, he's like, the only thing I've heard about this movie is the end, and it has a big tribute to the first film. I'm like, well, what is that? And he's like, oh, you don't know? I'm like, no. He goes, well, you'll see in the end. And the end comes, and I was like, wow. Like, that's where they went. Because, of course, I knew about the Statue of Liberty, as I mentioned in that first podcast, but I'm watching the way this is developing and the way all these apes are cops, and at the time, I was just kind of confused by it. I got to tell you guys, I watch it now. I kind of dig it. I kind of dig this twist. Does it make a lot of sense? Not really. But I do think this twist is a good way to make a cliffhanger for what the next film will bring, even though we never got that next film. But I kind of dug the head spinning what the fuckness of it.
I got to say, I don't have a problem with it. You know, I remember at the time being like, what? You know, and is it a little silly to have apes driving cop cars and stuff? Yeah, sure.
Yes.
But I was all for Yankee Stadium being filled with apes. So, you know what? Having a statue of Thade and even the inscription behind him, I think it fits. I think that fits much more into a story than the preceding freaking 105 minutes that I just watched. Like, I think this actually fits well. And I would actually want to know the how and the why behind this part of it. It just, I got so much less of a problem with this than so many other things. Is it a Sixth Sense M. Night ending? Yeah, but there's a reason for that. And I think it does fit into the apes universe as a whole.
And Matt talked about, in the beginning of this podcast, he talked about how many endings they were coming up with. And I got to say, Matt, was there one that you heard that was better than this one?
No, but you'd be hard pressed to find a worse one. I think this is strictly here for shock value, logic be damned. The problem I have is that when you take a step back, okay, the problem is not that Thade beat him to the punch. It's that when you think about it, ape society mirrors every single thing we did as humans. They built the Washington Monument in the exact same spot, directly over the pool. Like that, the architecture has not changed at all. Outside of a fucking ape head.
Well, that's part of the shock of
it. It's still stupid. It doesn't make any sense.
It makes no sense that he's in the same exact spot as Abraham Lincoln is. But like I said, I didn't really have a problem with it. I just kind of took it as them having the exact same instincts and building it. I really didn't think too hard about this. And this movie's not asking you to think. And that's a big issue I have with it. Is this movie's not asking you to think. It's just asking you to take everything in. And by the time this came in, I was just kind of taking it in, waiting for it to end. And when this showed up and I kind of remembered what was coming here, I didn't think too hard about it. I just took it as a Michael Bay film. It's just, you're just supposed to, quote unquote, turn off your brain.
It's funny because I knew it was coming and I was expected to be like, ugh, I'm going to freaking hate this, but I'm going to watch it to the credits. And then I was like, that actually didn't bug me.
I think it's because the rest of the movie is so dumb.
Maybe. Yeah. But it's also, I mean, the Statue of Liberty has no reason being buried to her shoulders on a beach.
That's
like,
true,
that doesn't fit from a, you know, logistical type of standpoint. So I guess this, in the same way, didn't bug me.
And I think it's a cop-out to say, on Burton's part, oh, the ending was not supposed to make any sense. That's just an excuse for lazy writing.
It's an excuse for a director who's just looking to get the hell out and settling on what he had.
He doesn't even have a line. He just cuts the credit.
Yeah, that Marky Mark confused look.
Exactly.
What?
No. Should have been framed as a potted plant.
This, to go back to Batman, it reminded me of the end of that first 89 Batman film where we talked about it when Jack Nicholson was walking up those stairs. He's like, why am I walking up here? And Burton's like, I don't know, just do it. It's what's in the script. It just kind of feels like he's on cruise control here, just getting.
You know what? I'm going to take that Wahlberg line from The Departed. Does it make sense? Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe go fuck yourself.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, Burton's theory on screenwriters is to treat them like mushrooms, feed them shit, and keep them in the dark. So quote The Departed. Because that's what moviegoers felt like when this movie ended. So how do we feel about 2001's Planet of the Apes? Let's go to Garrett first.
Oh, I'm first again, huh? All right. So in 2016, I gave this on my Letterboxd 3.5 stars. And watching it for this podcast with the history that I have, now that I've seen all these films and I've taken them in, that rating is going to go far down. Let me get some positives out of the way. I like the world that Burton's building. I like some of the characters that surround this village and this planet. And I like the fact that we are seeing a society being developed in much the same way that we saw in that first film. But in watching this movie, what they have done is they have dumbed it down. And I didn't see that in 2001. I definitely see it in 2024. There are some fun lines here. There's some decent stuff going on. I've mentioned some things that I did like, but the production design is really shoddy. The best compliment, like I said, I'm going to give it is for the makeup design. Despite what Adam says, I think a lot of the makeup here is tremendous. And I think Rick Baker fulfilling his wish to make a Planet of the Apes film came through, and he came through in spades. But this is a bad film. There's nothing really else to say about it other than the fact that I'm glad that sequel never showed up, because if you were going to do something on the same wavelength as this without Tim Burton at the helm, who knows what the hell would have come up. You leave it on the cliffhanger that you leave it on. I'm happy that it ended this way and not something that's all wrapped up, because Planet of the Apes as a series has never really been fully wrapped up in any of those films. Tim Roth is fun to watch in this. Helena Bonham Carter is giving it her all despite everything that's going on around her. But they also have Estella Warren around. They have Whistler wandering around the set aimlessly, probably just got done smoking a doobie with Willie Nelson. And we have Mark Wahlberg, who we've said enough about the underwear model without anything else to say. So I want to go with a patented 4 out of 10 on this. And if you had asked me in 2001, it would have been probably a solid 7, 7.5. But after I was given context, came out to be pretty shitty. So 4 out of 10 for Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes.
All right, Adam.
You know, this was one of two Planet of the Apes films that I had seen before we started this. I had seen this one, and I had seen Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which we'll be discussing shortly. I am so glad I saw the 5 ape films that we had seen before I got into this one, because it shows just how disconnected from a thought process, from a societal storytelling process, from smart sci-fi, Ray Bradbury type writings that we got in those other films, even some of the ones, the lesser films. You know, I was not kind to Beneath the Planet of the Apes, but this one feels just as shoddy as that film, and it doesn't have the wherewithal to say, hey, we still need to have a societal impact on the story we're telling. This is an empty film from an acting standpoint with few exceptions. Helena Bonham Carter, I think, does a fantastic job. I think Tim Roth does an absolutely fantastic job. I think Cary Tagawa does a fantastic job. Paul Giamatti is fun. I think he's in a different film. I think he does a good job. Outside of that, this thing is really difficult to watch. I mean, you got Kris Kristofferson in here, and I don't know if he even realizes he's in this film. The effects work is lazy. The opening space stuff looks like the odd number Star Trek films. Those of you who know what that means know what that means. And just the nonsensical plotting and slowness of this film. This is a 2-hour movie that has no reason to be a minute over a buck 31. Like, there is it. If you could have trimmed this down, I think it could have been a better experience. But it's laborious. It's got lazy writing. It's got, I can't even say it's got bad performances, because that would mean that there's a performance given. And I don't think some of these actors are even giving a performance. Maybe Wahlberg tries at times, and Garrett's brought up the point, and Matt reinforced, with certain directors, I think he can do good. Tim Burton doesn't like actors. He likes sets. He likes creatures. And I think he signed on to this film because he was going to get to design apes. Well, then he didn't get to design them. He didn't get to design production. He had to make action, which he can't stand. I think we had a director that was checked out, writers that got brought in to cash a check so that Fox could hit a deadline. This is a bad film. And it's unfortunate because this really should have brought something fresh and exciting. And it was should have been, you know, should have been like Pepsi, should have been the taste of a new generation. And it wasn't. I mean, this thing landed with a wet fart of that spaceship in the swamp. It's bad. I just don't know if it's worse than Beneath Planet of the Apes, but it's at least right there for me. I'm with Garrett. I'm at a 4 on 10, and I remember not hating this film in 2001, but you'll never see me willingly put this back in again.
You know, boys, I think there's a reason why this movie is as notorious as it is. It is smack dab in the middle of a landmark franchise that preceded it, as well as one immediately following it, certainly when you look at technology alone. We'll talk about whether or not the movies are deserving of that, certainly. But I hearken this movie to one of its contemporaries. This is the Roland Emmerich Godzilla to Planet of the Apes, in that it is very dumbed down for a common audience, following an original franchise that, particularly the first installment of Godzilla, did have a lot of commentary, did have something to say, as did Planet of the Apes. This movie doesn't have anything to say, and if it does, Tim Burton is not the appropriate voice to put that out there. His interest, like a lot of his films, is in the how things look. But even that is done a disservice, because I think a lot of the stuff was put in place long before he signed on to direct, as the history will allude to. I wish the writers put as much care into this movie as the actors who play the apes. That's dedication and craft. All I see is commerce, and it's a bad movie. It's dumb. It's unfocused. It feels like a glorified chase that does not need to be 2 hours. And for a movie that tried to pride itself on showing scale and battle, I think the action is terrible. But I'm still not going to call it the worst Tim Burton movie. As hard as it is to believe, I think he's made something worse than this. Will we ever talk about that movie? Who knows? But yeah, it's rightfully ostracized in the grand scheme of this franchise for good reason. I'm going to echo both of your sentiments and give this a 4. It's not the worst thing I've ever seen, but in comparison to what it's reimagining, he should have gone back to sleep and thought up another dream to imagine a superior product. But are we going to get that next week? Because this franchise sat on the shelf once again for another decade.
Well, you mentioned that there were plans. So was it like pretty much immediately after the film came out that they were like, even though it was making money, it was taking just a thrashing from critics. And so they decided after those reviews that they weren't going to do it? Or did they wait a couple years and announce, okay, well, we're shelving this idea?
Well, the rights, or I should say the Rise's development was 2006. So about 5 years. So it didn't take that long for them to look at other pastures. But it's funny. 2001, new Planet of the Apes film, at the beginning of Harry Potter. 2011, the end of Harry Potter, and a new Planet of the Apes film.
New Planet of the Apes film. Another one.
Yeah, so the second attempt at a reboot. When it was coming out, I honestly didn't care. What about you guys?
I was sent to review it, so I kind of had no choice but to try and care. But I didn't really find myself into the idea of seeing it when it was being released. I do remember the hype around it. And I did go to an early screening of this, and I have not watched it since. So it was a one and done. I saw it in theaters. I posted my review and I was done. I don't remember too much about it other than what was brought to the forefront when we reviewed Conquest a month or so ago. To answer your question, I was not looking forward to it. I am looking forward to revisiting it, though. I am looking forward to seeing what it was that made it make, it made a ton of money at the box office. I remember James Franco looking like he was high the entire time. I remember John Lithgow playing like he had Alzheimer's or something going on with him. I am looking forward to this particular viewing, but I wasn't back in 2011.
Yeah, for me, it was I believe it was a date night movie with Laura and I. When she would go to theaters with me a lot. You know, it was set in San Francisco. I was told that, hey, the guy that looked great in Lord of the Rings is now playing a monkey, so really good mocap. I was like, okay, cool. You know what? It's set here. Let's see what this is all about. Saw it in theaters. I think I've only seen it once since. I remember being stunned that Franco didn't survive the film. Spoiler. Because that kind of blew me away, so I didn't know even if it was going to continue after that. But this is the only other Apes film that I've seen, is the next one that we're going to see, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And not for any animosity that I haven't seen the ones after that, it's just, I just haven't. So I'm interested to go back to it. I'm interested to see how I feel it kicks off a new trilogy slash quadrilogy slash sextet, if they get all the ones that they want to do. So yeah, I'm down, I'm interested, and I can't wait to start going through those ones as well.
Adam, isn't it amazing that out of these 10 plus movies that we are reviewing, you and I have seen the exact same two movies before we started this retrospective?
That's nuts. Especially having a love for movies that, you know, yeah, that the kid on this trio has seen the original.
Yeah, exactly.
My expectations were non-existent, largely because I had seen the Tim Burton film and was not enthusiastic about them giving this another crack, even though it was a different team. I did have a certain amount of bias going in because August release dates can be very hit or miss, and 2011 was the box of chocolates era of summer blockbusters, where you had no clue what you were going to get. For all your X-Men First Classes, you had your Green Lanterns. For your Deathly Hallows Part 2, you had your Transformers Dark of the Moon. For your Fast Fives, you had The Hangover Part 2. So I didn't know what to expect, but I will say that the one thing that I was impressed with watching the trailers was, wow, the mocap has come a long way in just the 10 years since, well, almost 10 years since Two Towers really put it in the back of people's minds. But I didn't know what to expect, because I'm like, yeah, I know this franchise is predicated on being really smart and intellectual, but the Tim Burton film kind of took a shit on that, like a chimpanzee would do at a zoo. So who knows where was this going to fall on the spectrum? So I'm excited to talk about it. It's been a while since I've seen it.
Yeah, I'm curious to know, to see just how it launched, the franchise that it did, or was it the fact that it made so much money and they didn't have anything else to tell, so they had to make it up on the spot? So that's going to be my curiosity.
And on top of it, you got some of these films now over 55 years old that we find held up remarkably well, and ones that only 20 years old we felt there was no hold up whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So these have kind of run the gamut, and this is going to be really interesting.
So until next week, when we look at Rise of the Planet of the Apes, well, that's where my crew is, so that's where we're going to podcast. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Let me make a last appeal to your reason before we inflict more of this on you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast.
Thank you.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Tell me something, McDonald. Can we make the future what we wish?
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Aldo was right. War has come.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
So many questions I want to ask.
And if you enjoyed this review, please head on over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast platform of choice to access our Percolated Media archives and hear our reviews of other franchises like Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Pirates of the Caribbean, the films adapted from the published works of Stephen King, Top Gun, the DC Universe featuring Batman, the Superman DC Universe, and so many more.
And so, Mandemus, we must be patient and wait.
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Do they look like just apes to you?
Given the power to alter the future, have we the right to use it?
The Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast is edited by Garrett.
I'll abide by that finding.
Just hear what I have to say.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You just imagine that he hurt you.
For the moment, we should follow their example.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
In one of the countless billions of galaxies in the universe lies a medium-sized star, and one of its satellites, a green and insignificant planet, is now dead.
And then it changed again once Peter Jackson got involved.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he pitched, along with Fran Walsh, who I think is his wife. Mm-hmm. Now his wife.
Yeah, they're married. They're married. Damn it. Yeah, they're married.
It ended Mars Attacks, which was a massive bomb, despite having one of the most star-studded casts mm-hmm. you will ever see in a movie. Like, it's insane when you read that cast. I want to know what the call sheets look like. Yeah. On some of those days, it's insane. Unlike Adam, I actually really like that movie.
Never seen
it. I know one day we're going to discuss and fight over that movie. It's just going to happen.
Yeah, never seen it.
Now we got to do it at some point.
Oh, wow.
We should do like that and Independence Day as a double feature since they both came out the same time frame.
Let's talk about Bonham Carter. You know what? We've talked about her a few times on this podcast. You know, go back to the Potter shows. And, you know, we make fun of the fact that we've said it 100 times where at this time it was his go-to. They just broke up last year. I didn't even know this. You guys know who he's with now, by the way?
Tim Burton?
Yes.
Oh, don't tell me. Is it Monica Bellucci?
Yes. No. He is banging. Yes. No. He is banging Monica Bellucci. Uh-huh. We talked about the marketing. A funny part about the marketing, and Adam, I think you do remember this. Remember when Wahlberg was on Stern promoting this? Remember who he compared Bonham Carter's makeup to in that interview? He said that because Stern was asking him, you know, how is she? Can you be attracted to her? And he goes, oh, yeah, she looked like Janet Jackson. That caused such a fucking controversy. You can look it up. It caused such a stir when he said that.
It wasn't the Justin Timberlake thing not too long after this. She had a rough
year. Yeah, it was 3 years later. Yeah. He said, hello, I'm Bonham Carter, and her makeup looked like Janet Jackson. I'm sorry.
So Matt, I think she's great.
I had forgotten about this freaking... Oh, goddammit, what was that other Tom Cruise sci-fi movie that he did?
Oblivion.
Like that Oblivion-looking spaceship. And I get more passionate out of that one than I get out of Estella Warren, because neither one of those mouth breathers can close their mouth for a kiss.
I also still think I have to review Twilight just so he can bitch about that for 4 movies.
I was going to bring that up to you guys.
The answer is
I'll get my wife to sit on this with you. Go ahead.
But after I was given context, came out to be pretty shitty. So 7 out of 10 for Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes.
Don't you mean a 4?
I'm sorry. A 4 out of 10 for Tim Burton's Planet. Let me say it again. So 4 out of 10 for Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes.
What else came out this summer?
That's that long ago.
Yeah, for your Deathly Hallows Part 2, you had your Transformers Dark of the Moon. So until next week when we look at Rise of the Planet of the Apes, well, that's where my crew is. So that's where we're going to podcast. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. All right, we taking five?
Yeah, we're also going to have to take a shot if we're talking about this bullshit next.
All right, I'll see you guys in about 5 minutes.
It's getting angled.